Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine, the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Welcome back to The Critical Mash, the place where critics and creative artists get together to eavesdrop on the secret conversations works of art have among themselves. Today we're going to take a look at the relationship between cinema and music drama, musicals and operas. This is in the air because of the world premiere at Covent Garden of Mark Antony Turnage's Festen, based on the 1990 Danish film about family celebration that goes wrong, with horrific and perhaps comic consequences, and also because Stephen Sondheim's final musical, Here We Are, based on 2 films by the director Luis Buñuel, is landing at the National Theatre in April. As usual, we're being terrifically elitist about this. Now that every hit film is automatically turned into an opportunist musical, from Mean Girls to Clueless, but that rather vampiric industry is not really our concern. We're more in the territory of Stephen Sondheim's Little Night Music, which is based on an Ingmar Bergman film, and obviously The Little Shop of Horrors. And I believe, David, you've got, your favourite is Legally Blonde.
Oh, well, I wouldn't
say... As film that's been turned into a musical with great success.
Sorry, you threw that at me. I'm completely unwitting. The musical of Legally Blonde is surprisingly good. I went with a very arched eyebrow, thinking, really, is this going to work? And yes, it actually does. It's wittier than you think it's going to be and smarter than you think
and
it's going to be.
And then better than the film in many ways.
I think the film succeeds on its own terms. I don't think anyone's going to make a great case for it intellectually, but it's good fun. It's sharp and smart. And the musical is too. And sharp and smart are not actually words that people often apply to musicals, which are usually quite slack dramatically.
I got a bit ahead of myself there because I haven't even introduced him, but that was David Benedict, and I'll tell you all about him in a minute. And we're also going to have a look at the other side of the coin, where opera becomes film, or musical becomes film, which is again rather a kind of short but highly distinguished list, including various entries from Michael Powell and Emmerich Pressburger, to Bugs Bunny's Rabbit of Seville, to Max Offal's and Ingmar Bergman's Magic Flute. And as usual, we've got a high-tab guest list together to discuss this. So first of all, welcome back to Elena Langer, composer of several successful operas, including Figaro Gets a Divorce, which completed the trilogy of Mozart and Rossini, or Rossini and Mozart, and was adapted for plays, and has also dabbled rather successfully in the interesting area where opera and music theatre meet, first with the vaudeville Rhonda Rips It Up about the raucous life of the suffragette Margaret Haig Thomas, Viscountess Rhonda. And her next big project is a black comedy based on the banned 20s Soviet play The Suicide by Nikolai Erdman, which is going to be very much an opera, but aiming for that sweet Bernstein spot where serious music is also seriously entertaining. Is that a reasonable...
I hope so. I hope it's true.
We can only hope. Next, we have Don Boyd. Don is the extremely eminent elder statesman. Can I say elder statesman?
If you like.
Okay. Of the British film world. I was kind of worried, no. Or middle-aged.
Most people think I'm about 9.
Right. That's probably your wife and family, yes?
Yes. Yeah.
The eminent statesman of the British film world. Director, film producer, novelist, writer, lecturer on filmmaking. And his film work, which is quite rare for a filmmaker, it seems to me, has always had the closest connection with opera and music. In the 1980s, he produced the celebrated British films like Scum, Derek Jarman's The Tempest, and the opera film Aria, where 10 directors took on, or illustrated, 10 different arias, including Derek Jarman, Jean-Luc Godard, Julian Temple...
Robert Altman. Nicholas Roeg.
Right.
Ken Russell.
Bruce Beresford,
good.
And others? Well, anyway, Ken Russell is unforgettable. Yes. And then he returned to his directorial career with a number of films and many celebrated documentaries. He's an honorary professor at the University of Exeter, was a governor of the London Film School for 30 years, and was artistic director of Highbrow TV, which obviously makes him our kind of guy. Which was an online platform, which is an online platform for the arts now on YouTube, where he has created several hundred hours of original arts programming. And that chap who was talking earlier, my fellow journalist, David Benedict, is the admirable thing, a gamekeeper turned poacher. Started out as an actor, then very quickly came over the fence to the dark side where the critics lurk. Has been theatre editor on The Independent, arts editor of The Observer. He's chief London critic of Variety, writes a weekly column in The Stage, and knows everything about theatre, opera, and musicals. He's writing the authorised biography of Stephen Sondheim, and is a very well-known character in The Archers, frequently referred to by the name of Tristan Hawkshaw. I'm sorry about this enormous preamble. I'm your host, Robert Thickness. This is Critical Mash, the antidote to ghettoised art forms and dumbing down, the gateway to consciousness-expanding conversations about the things that make life worth living. Now, so the opera world and music theatre world has always been incredibly heavily reliant on adaptation of plays or novels. And so the modern tendency, or growing tendency, to scavenge for subjects in films, now that new theatre has basically been handed over to student diatribes, makes complete sense and presumably is going to grow. Don, I just wanted to start with you, because your career suggests that you find a very close connection between opera and cinema, and, you know, they're perfect bedfellows in some way.
Very much so, yes. I have a passion for both art forms. I'm a filmmaker by profession, but I'm a lay opera lover, and that's quite broad in terms of what I like and what I don't like. For instance, you were bringing up the question of films becoming operas. I went specially to Salzburg to see Thomas Addis' opera, Exterminating Angel. And I went with the same sort of cynical attitude one would to seeing what I regard as a masterpiece being turned into a piece of opera with artifacts like live sheep on the stage, and which is a factor in the original film, and was fabulously surprised at how much I loved the show. It really worked for me. Very abstract designs, cleverly organised, and it made me think very carefully about how on earth he arrived at the idea of doing it and constructing it. So that's the sort of unusual element to my passions for opera to film. Or film to opera. I never really rated that idea much. And to be honest, to this day, I don't particularly rate it. There's a movie and there's an opera.
Right. Never the twain shall meet.
And well, I think
I'm kind of in agreement with you. Yeah. I think the forms look similar, but are utterly different. It's interesting because I didn't like The Exterminating Angel, but I'd only ever seen the film once, and I didn't have great love for it, and therefore I wasn't there looking at how well individual moments, sections, ideas were being realised. And for me, I found it startlingly undramatic. There was extreme emotions in the score and in you know, stratospheric soprano writing, but I found it nearly all was pitched at a level that just didn't make it work.
Where did you see it? In Salzburg?
I saw it at Covent Garden.
Oh, you saw it at Covent Garden.
You had the same kind of reaction, Lena.
Yes, I saw it at the Opera House, and I'm not a film specialist, and so I was listening to it as to a piece of work, just musical work. That's, and I love Adessa's orchestral music and some chamber music, but the opera didn't work for me at all. It was even painful on a physical level, just the level of noise and the vocal lines which were jumping around crazy without justification of text. So the text was on its own and the music was jumping around.
But yeah, you know, that reflects the film. The film actually is a film that jumps around and has abstract ideas occurring out of nowhere somewhere, and you don't understand why they're there at all, and you sort of take it as part of the idea. And in that sense, the music reflected the film in a strange way.
It's not really supposed to reflect the film. I mean, it's supposed to turn it into something new, right? And
to be its own
change
thing,
the language from a film language to a theatrical or operatic language.
Yes, I don't think anybody went along thinking, oh, great, this is because I love the movie. They went along because they wanted to see Thomas Addis's new opera.
Yes.
They obviously, people do, I mean, that's one of the reasons for doing these things, although some of these movies are quite abstruse, I suppose, like The Bitter Tears of Petrophon Kant, which I wanted to talk about later. But they're all kind of predicated on that, aren't they? You've seen the movie, you've loved the movie.
Well, yes and no.
Now we'll introduce it to an even smaller public.
Yes and no, I mean, it depends what you're doing. If you're Disney and Cameron Mackintosh and you get the rights to P.L. Travers's works and you do Mary Poppins, yes, virtually everybody I would imagine that goes to see Mary Poppins on stage, the musical, has probably seen the 1964, I think, film. If you're Rufus Wainwright and Eva Van Hove and you decide to dramatise, allegedly, opening night, the John Cassavetes 1977 film, I doubt there was anybody in the auditorium, except maybe on press night, I doubt there was anyone who had actually seen that film. It's very obscure. People were there to see Sheridan
Smith. It's quite a tough watch, isn't it? They were absolutely to see Sheridan Smith. But with like something like Lost Highway, I bet the David Lynch fan club went along to Olga Neuwirth's you know, I mean, she would have wanted them to be, and you know, it kind of presupposes a knowledge of the film, I think, as well. I mean, in the same way, that, you know, like in the 19th century way that everybody knew Walter Scott before Donizetti did Lucia di Lammermoor and all that kind of, you know, everybody sort of knew the text before.
We'll talk about Lucia in a minute, but yeah. but I'd be interested to know what the balance is between the people that go along to say Vanya, which has been recently at the National Theatre, very successfully reviewed and a completely brilliant evening, where the percentage of people who go to that Vanya are going knowing anything of Uncle Vanya as the play and going along because they want to see Andrew Scott doing an extraordinary, almost, well, it is, it's a monologue, one man version of
playing all nine characters.
Yes.
I wanted to get back. I mean, that's all good. We're going to talk about all that in a minute anyway. But I just wanted to bring Lena in because, Lena's at the coalface here as a composer who, by the nature of what you do, you tend to, you know, I mean, there are sometimes you use original subjects, but very often you take something from somewhere and turn it into something else, or a song or a theatre piece.
Yes, sir.
By the way, I didn't get you here in order to insult your colleagues like Tom Addis, because that's our job.
a member of the audience in that
right.
case.
I mean, if you want to make your peace with Tom at any point, you know, or any of the others that we're going to
already
mention.
I had an argument with him because I said that I didn't like the Rake's Progress at some party, and we were on the balcony, and he said, "I will throw you off the balcony."
Yeah, he adores the Rake's Progress.
Okay,
so it's all ruined.
Just continuing the argument, that's good, fine. But so, you know, you've adapted plays and so forth to opera. Would you, if you were going to adapt an opera, would you go for these, you know, kind of Buñuel or Bergman type things, or would you tend more to the kind of Bridget Jones's Diary?
I would never make an opera out of film, but if I had to, I would definitely do the Bridget Jones Diary. Only if only in order to set, I don't give a fuck about Chechnya. No. Just to set this line to music would be fun, and many others.
Why do you say you would never adapt a film?
I would never adapt a film because, again, when I'm very impressionable. When I watch a film, I'm so absorbed in it and involved, and it has so much information, visual, and the actors, how they speak. It has music, or even if it doesn't have the music, it has atmosphere, it has light and design, it has everything, and it feels like there is not much space for my imagination because my relationship is with the text, with text. And text gives me the words without anything, just black on white. They make my imagination go somewhere maybe more interesting or original. Some people are successful at doing this. I probably wouldn't attempt.
Well, this problem with theater, with films, or the difference between a film script and a theater script is that a theater script kind of presupposes a million different productions. But a film script, the film is the film. There's only one production.
Yes,
of
it's
film
kind
script.
Of chewed up already and, by yeah. somebody else.
And you know, it's not Hamlet. Hamlet, you know, when you can take Hamlet and you realize, you know, everybody's done it a million different ways.
People remake films sometimes.
They do remake films, not
usually disastrously.
Usually disastrously, exactly. Yeah.
But also, they also film
and always opportunistically.
Yes.
Nearly always.
Yes.
It's to do with how you handle narrative and drama, and film scripts are much, on generalisation alert, but film scripts are much shorter than play scripts. There's far less dialogue in a film because the camera is doing the work. And you have, always in film, you have POV. It's like, where is this being shot from and why and from whom? And therefore, that is something you do not have in theatre, whether it's sung or not. And if you try and adapt film, you have to deal with the absence of all those things. And the chances of being able to fill that with music seems to me to be very, very slight. I think it performs a different function. I'm with Elena. I think, of course, we can probably find, you know, Don loved The Exterminating Angel. But on the whole, I think it's an error. I can't think of a really successful opera that's come from a film.
Well, I'll tell you one, which is Dead Man Walking. I mean,
I didn't see.
Right, but it's kind of the most successful 21st century opera, I think. I mean, it's been done, had so many productions all over the place. So Jake Heggie, I mean, he's one of this, you know, the new breed of, or newish breed of American composers. There is a gang of them, Mark Adamo, I mean, they're kind of heirs of Menotti and that kind of thing, I guess. And I'm always kind of surprised by the idiom they use, because the American music has so many available, amazing available idioms, as Bernstein demonstrated, and, you know, I mean, as he would take idioms from everywhere. But contemporary American opera seems to take the kind of gloomiest and least exciting of all available idioms. And of course, Americans have a peculiar idea about opera, right? They think it's all posh. And it's kind of typified by the Met. But Jake, I have to say that Jake Heggie's Dead Man Walking and his other ones really are quite good. And you can see why they're so effective, because it's a kind of MOR musical idiom, which is kind of somewhere between, someone said it's between the Warsaw Concerto and West Side Story, but without any of the tunes. And that's kind of it. So it has this kind of burgeoning romanticism, but it never quite... But it, you know, and it follows the drama, and it allows a human drama, obviously a very strong human drama in the film, which had Susan Sarandon and
yeah.
Sean Penn, and was directed by
can't remember,
but you know, was a very popular film, and about the guy on death row who is kind of tutored towards an acceptance of his crime by a nun called Sister Helen Prejean. And of course, the other thing about the opera is that usually sung, Helen Prejean is usually sung by Joyce DiDonato. And Joyce is such an amazing singer that she will kind of bring dignity and class to anything that she's in, a bit like Tom Hanks as an actor.
My question is, having not seen it, so for me and the listeners who have not, is it actually good, or is it a famous title that will get people to the theatre, the remembering that title, and as you say, the casting of Joyce DiDonato.
It's all these things.
Or is it actually, regardless of any of that, a really terrific piece?
I mean, it's piggybacking for sure on this, you know, emotive and kind of, but it, you know, which could be an awful sentimental thing. But actually, he kind of avoids that. A lot of his contemporaries, I think, wouldn't avoid the sentimentalism of it. Jake Heggie is quite self-denying in that.
I'm interested in asking you, Helena, what is the catalyst for your work? I mean, how do you arrive at what you decide to spend a couple of years working on if it's an opera?
Yes, it's a good question, because our colleagues 300 years ago used to spend a month on writing an opera, and then you can be maybe more promiscuous with your subject.
Yes.
Now, since you have to spend, it's all became so sophisticated and complicated and involves so many things. Now you have to, George Benjamin was saying that it takes on average 5 years from beginning to the realization. Now it's even more terribly important to choose a subject that I want to live with for 2 years. And
by the way, the same exists with the movie.
Mm. Yes.
Yeah, I mean, it could be longer. I mean, there's one project I've got which has been 18 years in gestation, and I'm not giving up on it.
How long did it take to do Casablanca?
Well, that's interesting, because it would have been a few months in gestation as a script before it became a film. I wouldn't have thought they'd have had very long to shoot, maybe 7 or 8 weeks.
Yeah.
Probably 6 months.
Because I mean, that does speak to something really interesting, which is, of course, it's something like Casablanca, a Warner Brothers movie is happening at Warner Brothers Studio at their peak. There's an entire industry,
exactly.
There's a department
yeah.
of for absolutely everything. So you can get something into production very, very quickly. These days, independent film, and indeed independent composers making opera, are, yes, you're probably commissioned by an opera house, but it's a much more slow-moving operation. The middle, you know, making a film in the heyday of the Hollywood studio system, absolutely everything was sitting there waiting for more product because they were producing so many films a year.
When we made, for instance, The Tempest, directed by Derek Jarman, I had access to some money. Derek came in with a 32-page script, 32 pages of Shakespeare, and it was brilliant. I thought, wow, we've got to do this. We cast it quickly, and we shot it, and it was out within 9 months or 10 months.
Wow.
in theatres throughout. And it was a pleasure. It was 6 weeks of shooting. The editing process was relatively quick. And it's regarded very highly as a movie of some substance. Should it take much longer? Would it have been any better much longer? No, I don't think so. No, I think the fact that... John Cassavetes, the great American director, there's a very mistaken thought that Cassavetes improvised his films, which is just not true. He wrote them. He allowed the actors to alter and change while they were shooting, but those were shot very quickly and they're absolute masterpieces. There are about 6 or 7 really brilliant films made extremely quickly.
Well, some operas I wrote pretty quickly. It doesn't have to take that long if you love the subject and the words are good.
Yes.
Sometimes it writes itself and then you have to orchestrate. It's just the physical amount of, you have to write a vocal score,
yes.
and then you have to orchestrate
yes.
all of
no.
this and
yeah.
grow it
yes.
into a big orchestral
that's,
piece.
That's
but
right.
I
was going to ask you, do you, in your case, come up with musical ideas before the libretto exists?
Well, I have an overall kind of spiritual idea of
right.
the piece, whether it's a comedy or something else. But coming back to your question, I like to select subjects which have everything, because there's very little time I get one chance to do
right.
this piece, and I chose Erdmann because it had everything, all the ingredients which made the opera, The Suicide by Erdmann,
mm-hmm.
all the ingredients which opera needs. It has over the top characters, characters change and transform, and it has lots of humor, and the humor is different from slapstick to sarcasm,
mm-hmm.
and it's about life and death.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to think about
love and death.
Life.
I know, but I would say love possibly as well.
So I think you've got to like the characters. And what I require from my librettists is that each character has their own rhythm and their own language and their own pace. Very often opera libretti, they're written in a way which is like one continuous thing. And so the characters are not distinguishable between each other.
Yes.
So when I was writing this Erdmann thing with my librettist, Russian librettist, I asked him specifically to give the main hero's wife a couple of rhythms like hexameter and something else, and heavy. Some other character comes with chastushka. It's like a frivolous, folksy kind of Russian little silly song, nursery rhyme almost. So I love when every character has a different rhythm, and then music, it's easier to write the music, and then they're different. They
come. I'm from a generation, this is now giving away my age, I'm 76, that worked all my early films on film, on 35mm film, and the structure of editing a film was absolutely non-computerized. It was all done by hand and by tape and by a moviola, vertical moviola. But I then transferred to the digital, to the computerized systems, the software that allows you to edit like that. And what I discovered was that you lost the opportunity to think carefully about a decision you made. That you would make, on the old moviola system, the old film system, you would cut a sequence to music, and music being a very important element in the way that you constructed a scene, you'd have to have the track there of the music, as well as the picture track. You would edit that and cut that in you know, literally manually. And then you'd look at it on the movie and you think, no, there's something wrong. And then you'd stick the piece of film into the basket and go back to the system and start again. And your mind definitely was used at that stage to think, to the thought process. Possibly the equivalent of writing, handwritten writing, and then transferring it to a computer screen after you've done that. Maybe not, I don't know. But when I began to do the electronic thing, I noticed myself getting lazy. Now, I don't know whether there's an equivalent situation with surveillance.
I think it's equivalent because when we write by hand, then you've got to imagine how all these instruments will sound.
Yes, yes.
And then Sibelius gives you immediate yeah. sound, and you just, yes, you become your ears and your taste, it becomes more lazy. So
yes.
It's sometimes I have to force myself to go away from the computer and just do it by hand to make it better.
Leonard, what would you say that music, adding music to something like Figaro or The Suicide, adds to the piece? I think this is the question that people want to know about contemporary.
Well, you've asked Leonard, so I shouldn't leap in.
I'm asking Leonard, but you will leap in,
yeah.
I can tell you. I'm coming to you. But well, you know, there's adaptation, right? You're not just doing Clueless the musical. Are you? You're doing something else. You're enhancing. You're making it into a different creature. And you know, I mean, as Mozart did with Figaro, or Benjamin Britten did with Turn of the Screw, you're kind of making it better as well, right?
Yes, I think that's the goal, to make it better. And I'm very romantic about this. I think that it's magic. If the piece is successful, it means that some magic took place, and this magical marriage between the words and the music, that it happens. I don't know how. Sometimes it happens. Sometimes it doesn't. But music just transforms the story onto a different level. It's all absorbing. I don't know, sometimes I feel when I sit in the theater, opera theater, and there are 50 very good operas, and we just continuously listening to these 50 operas, and we like them, and they give us a lot of information and satisfaction.
Incorrect information, often.
Yes, but it's correct. Then I feel that all of this absurdity and this music and these words, and it's untrue, but somehow it is more true than whatever is happening outside of the opera theater. I cannot give a logical explanation.
Well, so that's a kind of emotional truth,
It's emotional truth, and
it's beyond the tawdry bounds of reality. Obviously,
I think you've asked the wrong question.
Uh-huh.
I don't think if you're writing an opera, you're adding anything. I think you're reimagining it, and it's not about, well, I've got a play and I've added music, and therefore it is more emotional or whatever. It's good operas, no matter what they're based on, original stories or adaptations, are something where the ideas, and crucially, because it's opera on a stage, the drama is realised musically. It's not about a story being told, precisely to use that word, told. It's about it being expressed musically, orchestrally, vocally. Adding seems to me to be... the idea of adding music is completely understandable, but actually completely wrong.
Yes, some practical things I can list. When I was writing Figaro Gets a Divorce, I worked with the old and fantastic designer Ralph Koltai.
Oh yes.
Who and he was 93, I think, when we collaborated, and he said, you know what, I don't want any curtains, I want everything to be moving continuously, so we will use these panels and they will be turning, so we will need some music for when the panels are supposed to be turning. And he and I knew where the music was needed, but it coincided with the idea of the piece where the characters are in a state of constant immigration, constantly running away from one place to another, to another, to another. And then I thought that this turning panels, I can use it to make music of movement, of escaping from one place to another. And as a result, there was a layer of music in the opera, which didn't have any words, but had some meaning. And I was pleased with it, and then later I made an orchestral suite using bits of that music. So, and this can only happen in opera, such situations and such genesis. So it's completely different from plays or films.
I wanted to talk about words a bit, because I know that David has some strong feelings about contemporary opera libretti and how it's the words and the way they're written that undermines the opera.
This is not a criticism necessarily of the current opera presses of the world, but I would say 99% of the time, operas are reviewed on the basis of what the composer did, sometimes what the director did, and almost never what the librettist did. When Mozart was writing, he worked with professional librettists. When Verdi was writing, he wrote with professional librettists. And most opera houses that I have any knowledge of now don't seem to really understand what it is an opera libretto needs to do. It's not a short story, it's not a play, it is a form all its own. And like Elena just said about working with Ralph Koltai, that collaboration can be incredibly fertile. But what you don't want is to simply go, oh, well, this is a good play, I'll set it to music. Or somebody who doesn't understand how opera is about words and music happening in time. It's not, if you go and see a painting, you can look at it for 30 seconds or an hour if you wish. Opera is about drama happening in time, and not enough librettists know that. And I've seen opera after opera where I go, yes, the character is expressing all sorts of things, and there's what would be a lovely speech, and a not very inspired composer has dutifully gone along with that, and you go, well, this might be musically interesting, but it's dramatically inert.
I mean, there are different various ways of doing it, aren't there? Because you know, I mean, to say, I mean, Debussy just took Maeterlinck's Pelias and Melisande and pretty much set it verbatim without the intervention of a librettist. Poulenc did the same with the Carmelites, George Bernanos thing, which I mean, a very long word, big paragraphs about, you know, which are not kind of adapted for setting to music in any way, but they set them to music. And then similarly, when Gerald Barry adapted the Fassbinder film, Bitter Tears of Petra von Kant, for his opera, he just took the script. I think he edited it a bit, but he just took the script. And people are talking very inconsequentially a lot of the time in Petra von Kant. And he just said it. I mean, there are many different ways of setting words to music. Gerald Barry, for example, had these inconsequential things that these two women were saying to each other, being horrible to each other for an hour and a half, and then set them into a kind of blaring brass scales going up and down the kind of diapason of the orchestra.
And it was funny.
Which was funny, which he called a Nazi girls' march, which was also funny. and the two girls shrieking their lines basically over the top, trying to get through this barrage of sound. And it was funny, but it wasn't in any kind of recognisable way an expression or a setting of the words.
What I found very interesting about the transferring of opera music that existed in recordings to film in my film Aria was that each single director did not, and made the decision not to, certainly encouraged by me, try to in any way reflect the scene in the opera.
Yeah, completely not illustrative, yes.
And really annoyingly, some really stupid critics said, oh no, we can't possibly have our gorgeous piece of opera music ruined by Ken Russell or ruined by Nicholas Rowe.
I mean, this is before our time, David. It wasn't us saying these things.
No, no. but no, and so, interestingly enough, the editors, arts editors of various newspapers sent their music critics along to review the film. Really stupid, because they didn't understand what was going on. What they did, I don't know whether you've ever seen Aria. Have you seen Aria?
Yes, yeah. I remember the Ken Russell one that kind of stuck in. It was a long time ago.
Ness and Dorma.
Yeah.
Yes. What was interesting about the directors is they were inspired by the music. They didn't completely knock out the scenes in the operas themselves. It's a very, very funny piece by Julian Temple based on Rigoletto, which to a certain extent references the
that's the motel and the Elvis impersonator.
Yes. Going back to what you were talking about earlier on, which I found very, very interesting indeed, is that the catalyst for their work, what they did, was the inspiration of the music itself. They were inspired by the music. They thought, wow. And then they found an idea that they wanted to use the music for, and then express that idea through the music. So there was no intention to say, I'm now respecting the music for what it exists on its own. It's going to operate as a fusion with my art.
But if you've seen a kind of modern attempt to do something similar, there was this dreadful thing called The Seven Deaths of Maria Callas, put together by Marina Abramović, which had the arias and Marina's kind of direction of, in the same kind of way, not illustrative, of something happening to, well, Marina being killed by Willem Dafoe in various different ways. Right. During these seven, while a live opera singer sang the aria, orchestra played it very slowly to time.
Was this a live show?
Well, it was a live show. What happened was that the film was pre-filmed, obviously.
Right, yeah, of course.
And the orchestra had to play terrifically slowly in order to keep at the pace of the film, which, I mean, some things were just kind of ground to a halt, stalled in mid-aria. While this, an opera singer would come on sing onto the stage while the film was being shown behind her, and then off to the side, Marina was in. Did you see this one at the Coliseum? Right, Marina was in bed, being Maria Callas dying in Paris. And I mean, it was dreadful. It was like a perfume ad, or seven perfume ads.
Have you seen the movie Maria?
Yes.
I have too, yes.
Yes, I don't suggest anybody bothers.
No, no, I kind of agree. I do agree with you about that. Yes.
So we were mentioned earlier that it's not just about operas. There's also a strand of films being turned into musicals, which most people think about: Little Shop of Horrors, Legally Blonde, and Clueless, which is coming up soon. But we are more concerned here with the higher end of these things, but of which the highlight is Stephen Sondheim's Little Night Music, which was an adaptation, actually rather a faithful adaptation, of Ingmar Bergman's Smiles of a Summer Night, but put through the Broadway mill with a book by Hugh Wheeler and lyrics and music by Sondheim himself, obviously. And his Stephen Sondheim's swan song, which is called Here We Are, which is going to come to the National Theatre in April. Now, David, you're the Sondheim expert. He's a one-man industry. Tell us all about it.
He's classically trained, and he absolutely knew what he was doing in A Little Night Music in a five-week rehearsal period. The last number of Act One is A Weekend in the Country, which has a quintet and several soloists. It's something like a 7.5 minute piece, and it was written during rehearsals and. You know, I'm sure Elena will understand. Yes, and now it has to be orchestrated during rehearsals in order to happen. A professional orchestrator was always used. Jonathan Tunick did almost all his shows because he can work unbelievably fast. And Steve could have orchestrated, he said, but it wouldn't be as good. And that wasn't what his skill was. He actually adapted another film, Passion by, I'm not going to be able to pronounce his first name, Scola, an Italian film, into Passion, which opened in the beginning of the 90s. But Little Night Music is interesting because that it was a title that he'd wanted to use for something else. He took Smiles of a Summer Night because they couldn't get the rights to Jean-Henri's Ring Around the Moon, which was the musical that he and the director Hal Prince wanted to make. Henri's agent wouldn't grant them the rights, so they found something similar, a kind of tragic farce. It's such an interesting piece of adaptation. I mean, it's extremely successful, and Sondheim later described Hugh Wheeler's libretto as one of the six best books of a musical he could think of. It's very, very tight. It's very, very characterful. It's got a very good serio-comic script. The film is wonderful, and Bergman really liked it when he saw it a year after it opened. So it's a successful piece in which, for example, that Weekend in the Country section, I timed it, it's 40 seconds in the film. In the film, the mistress of the house gets handed an invitation for a weekend in the country, and there's a sort of look exchange between her and her maid. And Sondheim turns this into this enormous mini operetta at the end of Act One, which is absolutely extraordinary. And it does show you what you can do if you've got a composer with a dramatic imagination. He didn't just write songs, he visualized them. When the film of A Little Night Music got made, which is truly terrible,
With Elizabeth Taylor,
or as Hal Prince later described her to me, that woman.
She wasn't the worst thing in it, though.
No, the worst thing in it is Hal Prince, I'm afraid to say.
Exactly.
Who didn't have a clue about how to do it, and the fact that stage time and screen time are completely different. The way you fill them. Songs on a stage you can repeat, and you can have verse 2 and verse 3 and verse 4, and different things happen, and you don't. The audience doesn't sit there going, "What's happening? Why are these characters in stasis?" Whereas there's a scene and a song in A Little Night Music where the heroine and her former lover, who she's taken up with again, he's got married and he sings this song to her, "You Must Meet My Wife." Well, actually, in screen terms, that's all you need, is him saying, "You must meet my wife," and she goes, "Yeah, how charming, I have no intention of meeting your wife." That's all you need. The song lasts 3.5 minutes and it's dead in the water. But on stage, you look at the different permutations, because audience expectation of time in the theatre and time on film is so completely different.
And this is, that's exactly what he does as an opera composer would. Because he, as you say, he was trained by Milton Babbitt, which I didn't actually know until quite recently, and he said himself that he was like the only one of Babbitt's pupils who had the kind of the heavy artillery to students, whatever, to go into this thing. But he didn't want to be an opera composer, right?
No, he liked four operas, Grimes, Tosca. Wozzeck and one other that Porgy and Bess, and that was the limit, because he said the rest are for singers, and he's or for people that want to go for the singing, and he said, "I get bored easily, and if you sing about something for 5 minutes, I'm not interested."
Do you agree with him about that?
Not to that degree. I sang in an opera when I was 14, and I've been going to the opera ever since. But I think he's got a point about tension. I mean, Elena earlier talked about the fact that there are 50 operas, and I would agree there is kind of somewhere between 30 and 50 really good standard works in which the libretto and the music and the drama are all together. We could probably debate them for hours as to what that 50 would be. But beyond that, if you're going to go to the opera, you have to forgive something. You forgive the fact that it's an early work or that the libretto isn't that good. But I love it because it's got that aria or that sequence. But the really good stuff, like those four that Sondheim mentioned, or I would say things like Onegin. I mean, I think Onegin is an absolute masterpiece. It's the first time I saw it, I couldn't believe what I was watching because it's so dramatically tight. You go, oh, look, Olga's just, her lover has been shot. We're now going to get an aria of her singing how awful life is. And you go, nope, we just cut forward to several years later.
And it turns out she was fine with him being shot anyway. She was a bit relieved.
But you know, my point is that libretto is fantastically tight,
yes,
and really exciting dramatically. And that phrase, really exciting dramatically, is not one that you can use about an awful lot of the standard repertoire.
But this is the thing about, you know, again, an adaptation that you would think, you know, Eugene, you know, don't touch Eugene. The Russians initially hated Tchaikovsky's attempt on this because Pushkin was wholly untouchable. Don't mess with Pushkin. Yeah. And he came up with, and so it was slated at the beginning. And he couldn't get it staged.
Yes, it was at the conservatory that it was performed.
So the Bolshoi wouldn't do it, so he had to get the students to do it. And then very slowly it kind of caught on when people realised that he wasn't actually pissing on Pushkin, but doing something completely different, which is what adaptation.
That breaks my rule, which is basically don't mess with a masterpiece. Take something that, if you're going to do adaptation, take something that doesn't work, that music will make work. If you take something that's complete unto itself, what on earth are you going to do with music other than illustrate?
Well, David, yeah, you're really crucifying yourself in that remark, because surely you have to think about Otello, Verdi.
Of course, there are exceptions. Otello is
Macbeth.
I don't think Macbeth is. I don't think Macbeth is a masterpiece. I think it's got great, great things in.
But a great composer always gives an attitude. It's another attitude to those times, to now and here, and through the music, it just grows so many layers. And if it's a worthy, good composer, with his attitude and his symphonic kind of source, then it becomes something else.
But it's just—I mean—it's daunting to go up against a cast iron masterpiece, isn't it? I mean, you have to be kind of crazy. Tchaikovsky had to be kind of crazy to do that. That's the thing, and it's lucky he did.
Mm.
Yes, but yes. Before he wrote 12 operas and no one knows what they are, so he had lots of goals until he got it right.
Oh, right. When Sondheim was having trouble writing Here We Are, he got really stuck. Here We Are is two, as Robert said, two Buñuel films. So the first act is basically The Discreet Charm of the Bourgeoisie, and the second act is The Exterminating Angel. And he was really stuck on it. And I was at a party, and I was talking to the playwright Timberlake Wurtenbeck and saying, oh, you know, he's finding it really difficult, and he's moaning that no one in his 80s has produced a masterpiece. And she said, well, Sophocles wrote Oedipus when he was 90, tell him that. So I rang him up and told him, and he went, yeah, it's only a one-act play. But yes, he and his difficulty actually is expressed in the piece, because he wrote the second act and got stuck because everybody in the film is trapped. That's the scenario of the film. They're all in this room and they don't understand why they can't leave. And if you've got characters in emotional stasis, how do you write for them? You can't have a character grow, come to a decision and move on. It's like waiting for Godot, they cannot move. And he couldn't find a way to musicalize that. So apart from some underscoring and I think the first song, Act Two operates like a play because the director, Joe Mantello, who famously directed Wicked, the original musical on stage, and plenty of other things in America, he suggested to Sondheim that a way forward might be that to use the fact that they can't sing, there's no emotional reason for them to sing, to have it done as a play for most of the second act. So that's what you get.
I haven't seen it, but I understand Lost Highway as an opera has the first chunk of it is again words.
Yeah, I mean, there's no singing in Lost Highway. They kind of intone, and there's this kind of slightly diffuse soundtrack. It's really a soundtrack. I've been trying to be a kind of psychological soundtrack of what Lynch is portraying visually, with kind of snippets of kind of vile-type music and this and that and some pop songs.
That's probably trying to reflect an element in the film because the film was very, very good soundtrack.
Well, it's a very original way of approaching the problem of how do you turn something like a David Lynch film into an opera. I mean, this is what the thing about all these...
You don't try, is my opinion.
Well, I either don't try, but this, you know, all these...
But
all
it's
these...
so it's so it's like a pathetic attempt of opera as a genre to cling onto something so that people come... Or
they've always done it. I mean, what do you think? Puccini took the smash hit Tosca.
Did people? I've never seen Sardou's play of Tosca.
19th century theatre is no longer performed.
Yeah,
it only survives in opera form. It's been preserved in aspic by opera. But it was a smash hit with Sarah Bernhardt. He saw it in Paris. He said, "This is a smash hit. I'm going to piggyback on that." And improved it immeasurably in the opera. But you know, it's kind of okay if you do that, right?
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, if Figaro is the same. You know, Figaro was the Marriage of Figaro was a smash hit. Mozart picked it up in 2 years and said, "I'm gonna do this, but I'm gonna make it better." And of course, he did. So, you know,
did he have to pay Beaumarchais any money?
I don't know what the rights were exactly. This is what I'm kind of interested in. We should. I would like to move on to the question of operas into films, because although apparently nobody here has seen any, and Don doesn't approve of them,
I don't approve of them either.
David doesn't approve of them. But it was an interesting idea. So
of operas into films. No, I absolutely adored the Bergman Magic Flute.
Right, excellent. Yes. I mean, which was kind of a sort of film performance, but in a very stylized and
I did like Lucy's,
Don Giovanni. But Michael Powell's idea of the composed film, I think it was Powell who probably came up with it, right? And did it with, I mean, to a certain extent with Black Narcissus, and then to a greater extent, obviously, with The Red Shoes, which was where the film is in time with the music, basically, and then took it to the logical conclusion with Hoffman.
By the way, just jumping in on The Red Shoes, that's an example. In a sense, it's balletic, and the music, I think, was the film composer's music. But that transferred wonderfully to a ballet.
Yes.
I mean, quite extraordinarily well. And yet it's quite a complex film with a lot of dialogue and a lot of situations that happen that are very, very cinematic in terms of the very genre that we've been discussing, which is film into opera.
Yeah.
That was film into ballet.
I know, I get confused with all this.
Matthew Bourne sort of grew up watching film. This isn't a, oh, what could I do? I could take a film. It's like, no. Film is absolutely part of his knowledge, being, feeling, passion. And therefore, when he translates film, which he's done before, I think his masterpiece alongside Swan Lake is, the title has now flown from my brain. It's basically a dramatization of several 60s films that was originally called The Homecoming. Play without words. And that uses The Servant and lots of films of the early 60s. Mm-hmm. And everything is done with three dancers at once. It's like watching Cubism on stage. It's absolutely remarkable. But it's because he completely understands and loves film.
He called his company Adventures in Motion Pictures.
Correct.
Which is interesting. Sorry, I've interrupted your thought process.
No, about The Red Shoes. I mean, but I just wanted to... When I was thinking about these operas into films, it occurred to me that, you know, they're all 50 years ago. No one's done anything since about 1990 in this, apart from Marina Abramovic. No one's really done anything in this field since then. And I mean, I don't know if it's that because it's money.
I think it's because opera is no longer in the vernacular and culturally. And therefore, why would you want to turn an opera, an art form that is allegedly completely elitist and nobody goes to? Why would you use that as your base?
Although the things like the Zeffirelli Traviata were quite successful, and Bohème, there was a Bohème
a long time ago.
Bohème wasn't that long because it had an Netrebko and Rolando Villazon in it, so it wasn't that long. And
you know, but it's playing to a very small audience.
I'd like to jump in and say that I took that road.
Yeah.
I took Lucia as an opera and thought that's a basis for a movie. But what I arrived at was a sort of a cheat and a way to get round it, which was to make a film about a small opera company getting together and then reflecting what the opera was and the original Walter Scott novel was into something that's quite separate, using a large proportion of the Donizetti music. Mm. But that process was rigorous from my point of view. I said, right, this is not an attempt to make Lucia di Lammermoor as a film version of an opera. It was about the characters that are involved in performing this for themselves in a situation where what they were performing was reflecting their own lives. And so in that sense, I was stealing from the concept and the idea that it originated in Walter Scott's novel. So from that point of view, it was worth all the time I spent doing it.
I mean, the thing is that it seems to me that in many ways, particularly now that opera on stage is often scenographically challenged because of, drab, usually because of money, that the obvious place for opera to kind of reach its apotheosis is on film. And, Michael Powell would have said the same when Hein Heckroth had a field day with Hoffman and Bluebeard in those days.
But as you were articulating, you know, that experience of what occurs on the stage in terms of time and space and the emotional elements of it that are unique to the whole idea of a live performance of a piece of music that is based on a libretto, that has a magical quality, which you can absolutely, definitely ruin by trying to film. And what Bergman did, which was a brilliant cheat, is he said, I'm going to cheat. I'm going to have cameras on the stage and make sure the audience seeing this movie know that essentially a film is being made of the opera. And he revolved it around a little girl experiencing the entire Magic Flute. It's a beautiful film. Have you ever seen it?
I wanted to come to the conclusion that this was all the future, the marriage of opera and musicals and film were the future.
Can we address that?
Well, I think we have, David. I mean, that it's all over. I mean, I think the fact that all these films made from operas 40, 50 years ago kind of speaks like... But I am absolutely sure that opera scripts are going to come increasingly from films because, you know, modern theatre.
No, I think artistically it's a cul-de-sac for opera to be looking to film. I think opera needs... As Elena says, opera needs good stories, but I'm not sure that film is the place to look for them because they function so very, very differently. There are, of course, in every...
apart from Bridget Jones's Diary.
Exactly. There will always be the odd exception. You know, you could say operas... You can't make an opera out of a poem. Yes, you can, Peter Grimes. There will always be exceptions, but on the whole, I don't think that looking to back catalogues of movie studios is the best place to be finding your material. They're different things. You can sell them. That's the only reason that opera houses want films is because there's a very famous title and people will book for that.
Sunset Boulevard being a good example.
It is a good reason, but it's not a good reason for the creative team.
No. And by the way, on that subject of the creative team, you know, you don't have a formula. Let's find a perfect libretto from an opera that is going to be what we most spend time working on as a film. you have individual projects each time they crop up, and they're very idiosyncratic, and the choices are sometimes very subjective and very unusual. I would guarantee that most of the films that have been made from opera happened because whoever started was the catalyst for them artistically, was looking at the film and suddenly saw something and thought, ah, that's interesting. That could be something that I could visualize, could compose for. That's something that could inspire me, something that's spiritual or funny or unusual. Mm-hmm. And that's what produces that film, not the intrinsic concept of, ooh, actually, let's
and
look.
And it was producers like you. There's a guy called Daniel Toscan du Plantier, right?
Who did, I knew him.
Right, of course
he
did.
A film
and he was behind all those films.
So they were terrible, most of them.
Well, but one of them was the. Didn't he do the Zeffirelli? Didn't he do?
He did. He so did a couple of good ones.
And yeah. I think he did that Zhulavsky Boris Godunov that I watched.
But he loathed aria, loathed every second, and vocalized that at Cannes, which was so rude and unpleasant of him.
I think the point about opera is it's live. Yeah. It's live theatre. Yeah. And if you film it, you can. It's great to have a record of a famous singer or a famous conductor or a famous director's interpretation of a great piece. And if you're a fan of Domingo, you can watch films of Domingo in X, Y, and Z. That's great. It's not about the art form. It's about the art form has to be experienced live. Sitting in a theatre, listening to an orchestra and listening to a singer produce that sound live in front of you is what it's about. And on a sophisticated audio system, it just sounds like any other soundtrack.
I saw John Schlesinger's production of The Tales of Hoffmann with Domingo in it. And I remember John saying, I would never make a film of this. I enjoyed it for the live experience.
Kind of already was a film.
Yeah.
Lena, you wanted the last word. The last word, Lena.
No, I was thinking of films. I thought that I wouldn't take a specific film, but spiritually, Tarantino films, I thought, could make a pacey and fun operas when you have violence, which is funny, and kind of opera will take the seriousness of violence out of it too, so something.
Okay, how much do you think the rights to Pulp Fiction or Reservoir Dogs will cost us? We're gonna have to stop. I think that's a marvelous place to stop, and I'm looking forward to which one would it be, Reservoir Dogs or Pulp Fiction?
I don't know. We can make a hybrid.
Yeah.
Maybe it will be cheaper. Maybe
cheaper. Like sometimes. Fantastic.
That's all been marvelous. Thank you so much. It's been so interesting listening to you, Don, and talking about film, because we never, you know, we're locked in our music world. We never get to do that. And thank you, David, for the Sondheim insights, and Lena for telling us what it's all about. Thank you so much.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website www.thecritic.co.uk.